This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Power of Attorney, an educational program focusing on legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. And now your hosts, the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman.
Good morning, and welcome to Power of Attorney. Power of Attorney is brought to you by Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman, a full-service law firm with more than 50 attorneys located in Reston, Virginia, serving clients in the D.C. metropolitan area and across the country. You can learn more about Odin and Feldman and Pittleman on the web at www.ofplaw.com or by giving us a call at 703-218-2100. I'm Dave Zangrilli, and for those of you who don't know me, I practice exclusively in Virginia in the area of family law, or what some people call domestic relations. So I represent spouses going through a divorce, I draft prenups for people about to get married, and I handle custody and visitation cases and child support cases for parents who have kids but were never married. For the first half of today's show, I'm going to discuss issues that you want to consider including in your divorce settlement if you have children. So these will all be child-related issues. During the second half of today's show, I'm happy to say that I'll be joined by private investigator Kenneth D'Angelo, who will tell you how to protect your personal info from those technically savvy out there who may be up to no good. So when you're negotiating a custody agreement with your spouse, obviously you have the basics. What is the regular schedule going to be? You know, when is the child or children going to be in the care of the mom? And when is the child going to be in the care of the dad? Then, if you know, weekends, every other week, Wednesdays for dinner, what have you. Then, of course, you have the holidays. You have the major holidays, which we normally call Christmas, Thanksgiving, and Easter slash spring break. And then you have the Monday federal holidays, the children's birthdays, the parents' birthdays, 4th of July, Halloween, those types of holidays. Another common provision is driving. No one likes to drive in Northern Virginia, obviously. It's always a pretty big point of contention is who's going to be doing the driving. If you have one parent who's a stay-at-home parent, then, you know, obviously it makes more sense in a lot of cases for them to do most of the driving. Oftentimes, parents don't want to, you know, drive on that Friday because rush hour traffic on Friday is horrible, and they'd rather drive on the Sunday. 9 times out of 10, the judges try to be fair and equitable and usually make the parents, you know, split the driving. Except if you have situations where sometimes in high conflict divorces, the court will order that mom or dad will pick up the child directly from school and drop off the child directly at school so as to minimize the interaction between the parents and to minimize the unfortunate altercations and yelling matches and name-calling that often occurs at these visitation exchanges and all too often, you know, occurs in front of the kids. You also want to consider putting a clause in your agreement about telephonic visitation. Again, especially in high-conflict divorce situations, there are always problems with the telephone. Mom or dad calling and the child doesn't answer. Mom or dad then, you know, blowing up the cell phone, the house phone, the kids' phone, all the kids' phones, trying to get a hold of the children or the child. You have messages being left, sometimes nasty messages. Then you have, you know, the father or mother calling back every 30 minutes if they haven't heard back from the child or the other spouse. So you always want to try to include a provision in your agreement about telephonic visitation. It's a less, you know, if there's less conflict in the situation, then it could be a little more loosey-goosey. You can simply build something in which says, you know, each parent shall have the right to reasonable and liberal telephonic visitation with the child when the child is in the other parent's care. But unfortunately, in the high-conflict cases, you really have to micromanage the situation. Oftentimes, you have to say that, you know, father shall be allowed to call the children between 6 p.m. and 7 p.m., and if the child doesn't answer, then father will leave a message and mother will have the child call back within an hour or something to that effect. So you really need to micromanage that situation. And then you have, you know, parents fighting over cell phones and whether the child should have a cell phone and how old the child needs to be before they can have a cell phone. And, you know, if dad buys the child a cell phone, can mom take it when the child is in mom's care? So you have to really think about all of these situations and try to build into your agreement, you know, a clause that works and accomplishes what you want. So what I've just discussed, you know, the regular schedule, the holiday schedule, the driving, and the telephone privileges, those are pretty common provisions. If you were in trial, a judge would order those types of provisions. What I'm going to talk about now are provisions that judges will not order. Judges don't like to micromanage a family if they can avoid it. So these following provisions are provisions that in many cases I have found and my colleagues have found to be helpful. But again, they're not going to be ordered by a judge. Sticking with the telephone, we have emails and text messages. So we're talking about forms of communication. Some parents love emailing and texting the other parent. Some parents never want to communicate with the other parent. Some parents get angry when they send emails and text messages that go completely ignored. Some parents get angry when the other parent is just inundating them with emails and text messages. So you might want to consider including a provision which governs how you're going to communicate with your spouse or ex-spouse. Building in such a provision that, you know, the parties will only email or only text message about important decisions, you know, important issues relating to the children, and that you may even need to spell out in the written agreement the actual email addresses that each parent has. And you may want to say that if a parent sends an email, the other parent will respond within 24 hours or 48 hours. And again, these types of provisions are more useful in high conflict situations. If the parents can get along, then you don't need to micromanage and include provisions about emailing. Another fairly common provision is what we call the right of first refusal. This is when it's, let's say, mom's time with the child, but mom is unavailable for whatever reason. Maybe she's out of town for work. Maybe she simply wants to have a night on the town and spend some time with her friends, what have you. In a right of first refusal, in the situation that I just outlined, mom would have to notify dad as soon as she's aware that she's going to be unavailable and have to give dad the first choice of watching the kid. And then if dad is unavailable or simply doesn't want to for some reason, then it falls back to mom and mom can arrange for babysitting or care. People often fight over this provision. Some parents love it. Some parents don't. Some parents don't want to, oftentimes because they simply don't like their spouse or ex-spouse. They don't want to give the other parent the right of first refusal. They'd rather have, you know, a family member or a friend or maybe their new girlfriend or boyfriend care for the child. So oftentimes you get into that fight over whether you're going to include it in the first place. And if you do include such a clause, then you have to have the right wording in there. Does it apply if you're only running to Target for 30 minutes? Do you have to give the other side a right of first refusal? So you need to build in a time period that it only applies if the parent is unavailable for an hour or 2 hours or 4 hours or whatever you can agree to. Another common provision is what I call the paramour clause. Some parents want to say that the other parent cannot either expose the children to a new girlfriend or boyfriend or simply can't have a new girlfriend or boyfriend sleeping at the house when the children are present. This is obviously a hot button issue. You know, oftentimes parents will move on pretty quickly and they'll find a new love interest and they think that person's great. And the kids have met that person. The kids like that person. Maybe that person has children and the children are spending time together and they see no reason at all why, you know, they can't expose their new love interest to the child. So this is a real hot button issue, but it's something you may want to consider if you're worried that your spouse is going to do that. And I think the main theory behind this is that courts and people just don't want a revolving door of new relationships. It doesn't provide stability for the children. They don't want their ex to, you know, have a boyfriend, introduce the children to that boyfriend, and then 6 months later, that person's gone. And then we have another person, and the kids are just, you know, constantly meeting and losing people coming into and out of their life. So think about that. Another common provision that I think is a good one is to include a requirement that a parent has to notify the other parent if he or she is going out of town. I think parents should know and have a right to know where their children are going to be if the other parent is taking them out of town. So we can include a provision which says that, you know, the other parent, the traveling parent, must provide X number of days notice and must provide an itinerary and must provide, you know, an address and a phone number where the children can be reached. Usually there's not much disagreement over including a provision like this. Another good provision, which I found is not included too often in these agreements, is the passports. People always forget to include a clause about the passports. And then later, you know, they call their lawyer and say, hey, I need to get little Joey a passport. What do I do? Or, you know, I'm the holder of the passport and my wife or husband wants the passport. What do I do? So it can be very helpful to include a clause which allows you to either obtain a passport, or if you already have a passport for the child, to say who's going to hold it. You know, maybe mom is the holder of the passport, but if dad wants to go on an international trip, you know, mom has to give it to him 10 days before the trip, and then dad has to return it, you know, X number of days after he gets back from the trip. Then you have all the other financial situations that you can include in there about extracurricular activities, who's going to pay for private high school, who's going to pay, if anyone, for college, and how the tax exemptions are going to be divided. For all of those provisions, the tax exemptions are is the only one that the court actually has authority to order. The judges are not going to order a parent to pay for extracurriculars, unless in rare circumstances, which I won't get into. They're not going to order a parent to pay for private high school, and they're not going to order a parent to pay for college. We're going to take a short break now, but please stay with us. I'm Dave Zangrilli, and you've been listening to Power of Attorney, hosted by Odin Feldman and Pittleman. To learn more about Odin Feldman and Pittleman, you can find us on the web at www.ofplaw.com, or you can give us a call at 703-218-2100.
You're listening to Power of Attorney with the attorneys from Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Learn more about legal developments affecting individuals and businesses when Power of Attorney returns in a moment. A Legal Minute.
A commercial website's Terms of Use or Usage Agreement is its most important contract, as it sets forth the legal framework of the relationship between the website and its customers. Over the years, the Internet has highlighted a number of instances, most notably instances involving Twitter and Adobe, in which e-commerce companies have failed to undertake the analysis and thoughtful drafting required to develop customized terms of use, and instead have used generalized terms or simply borrowed the terms of use posted at another company's website. Even sophisticated companies are tempted to reduce legal expenses by simply copying or modifying the terms of use applicable to the website of a competitor or other similar business. In the end, the practice usually ends up being another example of being penny wise and pound foolish. Sidestepping the relatively inexpensive task of drafting customized terms of use often forces the company to spend large sums of money repairing a damaged relationship with its customers, or worse still, defending a lawsuit. For more information on this topic, please go to powerofattorneyradio.com and click on Legal Minute.
Welcome back to Power of Attorney, an educational program focusing on legal developments affecting businesses and individuals. And now your hosts, the attorneys from Odin, Feldman, and Pittleman.
Welcome back to Power of Attorney on 1500 AM. I'm Dave Zangrilli, and in the studio today I'm joined by Mr. Kenneth D'Angelo. Ken is the chief investigator of Target Investigations and Personal Security Services, Inc. He has offices in Gaithersburg, Maryland, and Reston, Virginia. Ken's been a private investigator for 21 years and is a former police officer in Rockville and with the U.S. Marine Corps. His firm specializes in the investigation of family law matters, and he also works as a personal privacy consultant. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, David.
Much like us family law lawyers, I'm sure you have great cocktail party stories in your line of work.
I do, as long as I keep the names and places out of them.
So we're going to talk today about how technically savvy individuals can acquire the personal information of others.
Okay.
Are people able to obtain the personal information of others?
Absolutely. I think, you know, if you haven't been in a cave in the last year, you've seen a lot of news about people who are able to obtain information. I woke up this morning and saw how Mr. Snowden has released an open letter to Brazil about the National Security Agency. And I think everybody is becoming increasingly aware that people can obtain this information. It's out there. And perhaps we're now sort of having a knee-jerk reaction to it.
And why? Why? Why are people, you know, trying to obtain this information? For what purposes?
Well, in my line of work as a private detective, and I specifically work in family law matters, the cases that I'm dealing with typically involve spouses who are obtaining information about one another, estranged spouses, partners, former partners. Of course, there are also others who may be engaged in the activity for criminal reasons, theft, identity theft, or even just hackers who are bored and they want to see what kind of information they can find out about people.
What, just to put a percentage on it, if you could, because, you know, in my line of work, we deal with PIs significantly more in terms of trying to prove that a spouse has cheated, as opposed to trying to gather evidence which would maybe help you in a custody case, such as, you know, showing that your spouse is going out to bars and nightclubs. What percentage do you think, if you could put one on it, do you get contacted for the adultery piece versus trying to gather evidence for a custody case?
Well, I would say that a lot of our cases, maybe even 75%, may start with the adultery piece, but then most of them can move into a child custody phase of the investigation and the case. Adultery has certain uses in the court, but they're limited. I think what courts are more concerned with are the issues involving children and how the children are being cared for and the condition of the spouses and so forth.
Certainly agree with that 100%. Now, you know, kind of like you see on TV, are people's homes still being bugged, people's homes and offices?
Well, not as much as you would think, and not as much as the clients think. I think that the tendency is to jump to that conclusion when someone is hearing that maybe a spouse or a former partner knows something that they shouldn't, that they're ahead of the game in the courtroom, that, oh, I must be being bugged. But in my line of work, I find it very, very few times. It's usually something that the client is doing themselves or putting the information out some way other than it being intercepted by a micro electronic device. We're all on the internet now. I think there's over 2 billion people in the world that are on the internet. 70% or 80% of people in North America are on the internet. And we're throwing out our personal lives out there in hopes that only the people that we want to obtain that information are looking at it, but that's not the case.
And tell the listeners, how does the collection process work, collecting this important information for your clients?
Well, it works bit by bit, or what we like to say now is bite by bite. There's no magic database. Sometimes we watch on television and the crime shows where the detectives will pull up a huge profile on someone with photos and it has everything on the interface there about the person. That's really not the reality of it. What we do is we start with the very basic information about a person. I have an advantage in the cases that I work on that my clients usually are very familiar with the people we're investigating. So I don't really have to go too far to find out what their names and dates of birth and
right.
their addresses are. But that may not be the case if someone were trying to steal another person's identity, but that information is on the internet. It's open. It's very easy to obtain. And so what the process is just to go one step at a time, and you get perhaps start with the name, date of birth, address, and then you go to another source, and you may look for a social security number. You may look for an email address or a handle that the person uses in an email address. As you know, some of us stick with what we're familiar with, and we use the same handle in several different systems. So once you have that, so you're basically just building on the information that you started with and going to different sources to collect that. So.
And tell us a little more about the different sources, if you would. I mean, how are today's technically savvy acquiring people's personal information?
Well, once again, they're starting with the very obvious and open sources, such as doing Google searches, Intellius, People. The court system databases are also another place that you can go and get information about people. Tax system databases also. Now, if you start with an address and you want to know who owns a house, you can go online to the government tax website and find out who owns a house. So they usually start with that method and then they build on it, just like we do when we're doing an investigation. Social media is huge. as we all know. And people are pouring their lives out onto these platforms. The average user of social media spends 3 hours a day on these websites.
Is that right? 3 hours a day?
Doing nothing but sharing their information about their lives. And many of us have our professional resumes online now and LinkedIn website, and you don't have to go very far to figure out some things about someone. But then you get into some of the methods that are perhaps a little more sinister. There are obviously ways of creating website profiles to pretend you're someone in order to gain someone's confidence. That's being done, whether it be a dating profile or a social profile, social media profile. There are hackers that are available for hire. I'm not going to name any names because I don't want to do them any favors, but there are websites that advertise that they can get the password for any email account for $75, and they don't care who you are.
And are they obtaining that? Are they hacking it legally or illegally?
Definitely illegally.
Yeah.
If you don't have the permission of someone's, when you're going into a stored communications system, you're violating federal law. But that is out there, and it is being done. And if someone wants to get the information and be able to go in and read emails, they can do it very easily.
And you're listening to Power of Attorney on 1500 AM. I'm Dave Zangrilli. In the studio today, I'm talking with Mr. Ken D'Angelo, a private investigator. Ken, tell us about GPS systems and cell phones. That seems to be big in the field today.
It is, and I'm seeing it a lot. In what we do, there are legal uses for GPS, and then there are those that sort of cross the line. We're all enjoying the technology that we have today and using it. I used my cell phone GPS to find the studio this morning. That's one of the good ways that this technology can be used, but someone could also be monitoring where I am based on where my cell phone is showing up on the system. So in family law cases, we find a lot of the information that people are gaining is through accounts that were once shared, and perhaps the party did not register a password or username and so forth, and so they were still able to go in and find out where that cell phone is.
Let me interrupt you if I could. Mm-hmm. So if I am the account holder with Verizon, for example, and my wife is on the same account, and we both have iPhones, could I track her and know where she is?
Yes, there's two ways. Verizon has a family plan that you can know where your cell phones are, and also the iPhone has its own system for Find My iPhone that you can use on the cloud. So theoretically, you could go in and see where that cell phone is.
So if I'm a cheating spouse, I want to make sure I have my own cell phone plan. That's the advice.
I'm not sure I'm the one giving that advice, but I would say you might want to be careful about that.
And GPS tracking devices, how prevalent are those?
They're very prevalent. This technology is no secret anymore. We've been using them for years. Now they're available in your local Best Buy stores and so forth that people can buy these things. There are some legal issues involved in using them that people should be aware of. They could end up in trouble. Certain states have laws that restrict the private use of GPS devices, so you need to be aware of those.
For example, you're talking about, you and I have talked about this off the air, that Virginia recently, amended its law on the use of GPS, and the statute isn't worded tremendously well. It's not super clear, but I think you and I agree that the statute essentially prevents me, for example, from placing a GPS on my wife's car unless I am the title owner of the car as well.
That's correct.
But there's an exception built in for law enforcement and other types of individuals.
Yes, and there is even an exception for private investigators who are licensed in Virginia with the permission of a vehicle owner.
course, as we have talked about before, the statute doesn't define what owner means.
Exactly.
But I think that'll be done through case law in the next few
Sooner or later, there'll be a case.
That's
hopefully
right.
Shedding some light on that.
Absolutely.
Now, what about police databases? Are PIs able to obtain any information from the authorities?
No, not legally. And you always run the risk of getting someone in trouble if you were to try.
A lot of the sources you mentioned online, I'm assuming those are free sources. Are there any sources out there? You know, you mentioned a hacker, you know, where you could pay $75. Are there other sources where you pay money that, or maybe that PIs are the only ones who have access to certain databases or information online?
Yes, we do have subscription databases. They're made available to our industry, and we're vetted before we're given those subscriptions, and you know, we have to be licensed and insured and so forth. And you would hope that any licensed private investigator would be using those systems for legal purposes and working on cases for their clients and not trying to violate anybody's privacy.
And what have you found to be, you know, in your own personal experience, the most useful of these techniques to gather information?
Well, again, knowing the whole variety, the whole tool drawer is very important as a PI. You need to know what system or what method you're going to use. And I think that comes with experience. You know, if you've done it long enough, you should know, well, this is what I need to learn. So this is where I go to try and learn that. If I wanted to learn where someone works, for example, there are several online sources that I would check right off the bat, such as LinkedIn. I would run a Google search, and there's also the subscription database may have that information in it as well. So
it's very much case specific, which yeah. methodologies you would employ to try to gain the information.
Correct. And that's why you're hiring a professional, is because they should know that how that's done and what the easiest and most cost-effective ways of doing it are.
And just quickly, what do you recommend are the best methods to make sure you're protecting your own personal information?
Well, there are several, and nothing's perfect. And, you know, of course, practicing good security with your devices and your computers, not leaving them on, password protecting them, not sharing them with anyone. You also need to keep these devices updated. You know, the threat is shifting to mobile devices rather than your desktop platform PCs. So you need to be careful with those especially. And also, you just need to behave. I mean, don't do anything online that you wouldn't want your mother or your priest or your rabbi to know about, because it's out there and it can be obtained, and you wouldn't want to be embarrassed about it later.
That's great advice. Ken D'Angelo, thanks so much for coming on the show today. If our listeners have any questions about anything you've talked about today, how can they contact you?
Well, they can go to my website, which is at target-investigations.com, or they can call our office at numbers 301-258-1150.
And if you are interested in these issues or any related issues, please visit OFP's Family Law Blog at virginiadivorceandcustodylaw.com, or you can email me at david.zangrilli@ofplaw.com. Thank you for listening today. Please make Power of Attorney a regular part of your Saturday morning, and check out our website at www.powerofattorneyradio.com. Tune in next week as I will discuss how assets and debts get divided during a divorce, and my special guest will be Ms. Kim Bradley, who is a real estate appraiser. Have a great week, and we look forward to talking with you next Saturday.
You've been listening to Power of Attorney with Odin Feldman and Pittleman. Power of Attorney will be back next Saturday morning at 10 a.m. right here on 1500 AM.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWT-FM HD2 Manassas. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. The Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, American University Eagles, Washington Nationals, and the Washington Capitals. Federal News Radio, 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.